Hello and welcome to For Now We See, a podcast where a Bible college student, that's me, Rhys, and a film journalist, that's George, talk about film and TV from a Christian perspective. This is our 2020 Christmas special. We catch up on November's film news before reviewing Disney Plus's Noel and Netflix's Christmas Chronicles 2. Stick around, listen in, and we hope that's all right.
She done told me, Papa told me too. The life you live inside now, women be the death of you. That's all right.
Hello and welcome back, everybody. It's been a while since you've heard from us properly. We only got one episode out in November, which was our crossover special with For Now We See, our friendly fellow Christian podcasters. Go back and listen to that. If you missed that, we talked about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We've gone sort of from one holiday to the next. The last time you'd have heard from us, we were talking about some Halloween movies, but this time, ho, 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 it is our Christmas special. We're reflecting, actually, our first episode came out last year on the 1st of December, and our second ever episode was our Christmas special last year. That seems like a long time ago for lots of reasons, George, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. We recorded it in the room I'm in right now, I remember. But yeah, I'd say there are a couple of our least listened to episodes, which I think is a real shame, because we really went into depth into thinking about the mythology behind the Santa Claus movies and thinking about the Christian story that is A Christmas Carol and its various incarnations. So if you haven't listened to them, go back and have a listen. Maybe you've seen those films now. So in the first episode, we talked about Last Christmas, the George Michael rom-com, which I called Bridget Jones's Christmas Carol. That's available on Now TV now. The other is Klaus, which is an animated film about the origins of Santa Claus. That's an Oscar-nominated animated film, and it's on Netflix. We really recommend that. I thoroughly enjoyed both those films, actually. And then we talked about the BBC's A Christmas Carol, which we weren't so keen on, but we do talk about Christmas Carol as a whole in that. In fact, just worth saying, since cinemas reopened, I popped by myself to an Odeon that was opened to see a new version of A Christmas Carol that was showing. Just because I love A Christmas Carol, and any new version I lap up.
New one every year.
Yeah, exactly. This one was with Andy Serkis, who was in the BBC one, but instead of playing the Ghost of Christmas Past, he was playing Marley's ghost. But the weird thing about this one was it had famous actors narrating characters, like Simon Russell Beale was Scrooge, and Daniel Kaluuya was the Ghost of Christmas Present, and Martin Freeman, sorry, was Bob Cratchit.
But of course he was.
But the actors on stage, they were mute and were talked over, and they were dancing or in theatrical sets. It's quite an interesting way of doing it, and I guess it's a different way to do it, but I found it a bit dull and uninspiring personally. But still, it was nice to pop to the cinema.
Yes, which is why we're not devoting a whole section of this show to it. But if you're like George and you want to see a new version of A Christmas Carol every year, then maybe give it a go. We are in our Christmas special. We're talking about a couple of new Christmas releases. Noel, which is on Disney Plus, and Christmas Chronicles 2 on Netflix. So we'll get to those in a bit. But as I said, it's been a little while since you've heard from us, and so there's been a fair bit of news that happened in the course of November. George, just after we recorded our Halloween episode, for you, some very tragic news.
Yes, on Halloween, very sadly, Sir Sean Connery died just a couple of months after his 90th birthday. The original and probably the best James Bond, a titan of the second golden age of cinema. But yeah, it's been quite sad this year to have, especially sad to lose Chadwick Boseman so young, Black Panther, and then to lose another icon of cinema, the original James Bond. He was quite something, Sean Connery, and I'd recommend seeing some of his good films that aren't James Bond as well, like The Rock. or maybe even Zardos, I've heard is very good, where he wears some quite interesting sci-fi clothing in that.
To me, he will always be Henry Jones Sr., even more than Bond, I think. That's how I will always
picture. Oh, yes.
Henry. Yes, yes. We called the dog Indiana. Yeah, excellent.
And as well, his cameo at the end, uncredited cameo at the end of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, as a returning King Richard of the Crusades. I always forget that until it happens.
Yeah, I think what we learned there is that we like Sean Connery with a beard. Which I think he had until the end, actually. So the loss of Sean Connery, very sad to see. Let us remember the great stars of the silver screen do eventually go the way of all flesh, and they seem immortal when they're up on the screen and our billboards and posters, but they go eventually. Which is something we have also probably seen in the news about Johnny Depp in the last month, George, as well.
Yes, Johnny Depp, who... was playing Grindelwald, the villain in the Fantastic Beasts films. He had shot just one scene of Fantastic Beasts 3. However, he lost his libel case in which he was accused by the Sun. Well, he was quoted as being a wife beater by the Sun newspaper, and so he sued them, but strongly denied those allegations, but lost the case, and so Warner Brothers asked him to resign from his role, which he willingly did quite quietly went. And now Mads Mikkelsen, who's best known for being Le Chiffre, the Bond villain in Casino Royale, has replaced him. And right now it's quite uncertain what Johnny Depp's future is, and whether, like so many Hollywood stars who fall from grace, like Mel Gibson, whether they'll be forgiven and allowed another chance. But of course, there's still the question around whether Johnny Depp has actually done anything wrong. Because, of course, this wasn't a criminal trial. This was a libel trial. And I was listening to a podcast today. It said in family law, when you're accused of something, like the Sun was accusing Johnny Depp, the burden of proof is on you to prove you're innocent rather than being innocent until proven guilty, which is questioned as being a moral or right thing in the law courts.
Yeah, no, look, I've followed it relatively closely, my wife having been historically a fairly big Johnny Depp fan, and lots of things thrown out on either side which are not directly relevant to whether or not Johnny Depp is guilty, but just throw up a very kind of sad and sordid life on both sides of him and his ex-wife, whatever the ultimate outcome of it is. You know, if he is someone who's been violent towards women, that is atrocious and awful, and as Christians find, the Bible is full of times where, you know, God is on the side of women who've been abused. So if that is the case, then, you know, we'd have strong feelings about that, but I know that is subject to appeal. But either way, the whole thing from beginning to end is a horrible, horrible story. So I'll slightly glad to see the back of it for now, and we'll be glad to see the back of it whenever it is properly resolved. So that dominated the headlines a bit in November. More recently, George, some big announcements about how cinema is going to look in 2021. As we ride out what is hopefully the end of the coronavirus pandemic.
Yes, Warner Brothers were the first to take the plunge in, I think it was back in August now, when they released Tenet, Christopher Nolan's new film, no doubt persuaded by Christopher Nolan to release his film in cinema as he intended. But the box office money didn't come back as expected. It was a real gamble. And so Warner Brothers have now decided that every single one of their 2021 releases will release in cinemas when cinemas are open, as and when, but they will also release simultaneously on their streaming service HBO Max. Now, we don't have HBO Max in the UK, however, we do have what's called PVOD, Premium Video on Demand. So, what Warner Brothers did with Roald Dahl's The Witches, Robert Zemeckis's new adaptation of that book, was in America they put it on HBO Max, whereas in the UK it was available to rent for about $15.99 a pop. So what's happening with Wonder Woman, this is going to be the first one, Wonder Woman 1984 in the US, is it's going to release on Christmas Day and on HBO Max simultaneously. But in the UK, we're getting Wonder Woman 1984, which I'm seeing next week, in cinemas on the 16th of December. And the rumours are that there's a deal going on with Sky to release on premium video on demand that film after a month in the cinema. But the point is, regardless of what happens in the UK and the US, obviously cinemas aren't happy about this because of their exclusivity window for their businesses, and they're already struggling on the risk of going out of business. Cinema purists like Christopher Nolan and Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn, who's directed the new Suicide Squad film out next year, are really, really not happy about this. And are saying how, you know, they thought Warner Brothers was the professional studio to go to, and now they're very unhappy about this. And critics like Mark Kermode and Robbie Collin of The Telegraph have said, perhaps they're being quite cynical, I don't know, but they just feel it's inevitable. Practicality was always going to come around, and this could just be the future, and the pandemic might have just pushed this forward a little early. And we might just have to get used to it being the norm that you'll have a choice of watching something at home or on the big screen. And I guess we'll make those judgments based on how much we care about the film or the practicalities of our own personal lives.
Yeah, could end up with the situation where going to the cinema is a bit like owning a vinyl record, where maybe, you know, it will be a bit bigger than we think it might end up being, but will largely be something for the audiophile and the cinephile or the hipster like me and George. But if you listen to this podcast, I'd like to think that you're a bit more of a interested in cinema than most people. So do all, or even if you're not, and you know, we're just your kind of go-to bit of advice for and what you do watch, and please go and support your local cinema as much as you can, especially if it is an independent one. And a bit of happier news for film fans. We had a lot of Spider-Man chat in the last couple of weeks, haven't we, George?
Oh gosh, yes we have. So we've had a fallow year of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I think is good. It's taken a break after the Infinity Saga ended last year with Avengers Endgame and Spider-Man Far From Home. And that was also the end of what's called Marvel Phase 3. And now we're going to get Marvel Phase 4, which begins on the 15th of January with WandaVision on Disney Plus. And the difference here is that the MCU going forwards is going to be a mixture of cinematic films and Disney Plus miniseries. Same with Star Wars. They're going to share a universe but interchange and follow the story along that way. And at the end of next year, we're getting the third solo Spider-Man movie with Tom Holland. And what's being teased for this phase of Marvelous, it's going to be exploring the multiverse. And what's been announced so far is that Benedict Cumberbatch is returning as Doctor Strange to mentor Holland's Peter Parker. But now suddenly, as has been heavily rumoured, and for years has sort of been pushed by fan posters on Reddit, the sort of the fan dream is becoming a reality. And Sony, who own Spider-Man and do a deal with Disney to have Spider-Man in the MCU, have signed on their two original Spider-Mans, Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, plus their love interests, Kirsten Dunst and Emma Stone's MJ and Gwen Stacy, plus Spider-Man villains Electro, that's Jamie Foxx, and Alfred Molina's Dr. Octopus, plus it's rumoured that Willem Dafoe will be returning as the Green Goblin and also the Green Goblin from the Andrew Garfield one. That's just a rumour. Plus Charlie Cox, who played Daredevil in the Netflix TV show, which again is another kind of questionable universe, how does that tie in, is coming back. I mean, it's just, it's all happening. I mean, they had to top Avengers Endgame somehow, and I guess this is the way they're going to do it.
Yeah, I think the word that a fan would use is squee. This is something to squee over if you're a Marvel geek. All I can do now is refer you back to our episode recently, like I've mentioned already, with the guys at Popcorn Parenting. on whether multiverses create or are evidence of a generation of narcissists. We'll tease you with that if you haven't listened to that episode, but go back and have a listen to Popcorn Parenting. Great. Okay, well, that's a lot of the news that we've had in the month. We've had off a lot of news since we've not been with you for a little while. So now we're going to get into reviewing our Christmas films. We said this is our Christmas special. This should be up a little while before Christmas. We're going to be talking about Noel, which is on Disney Plus, and Christmas Chronicles 2, which is on Netflix. So stick around while we talk about Noel. Okay, George, Noel, it's on Disney Plus. Tell us, what's it all about?
So, Noel Kringle lives a life of joy and Christmas cheer at the North Pole with her father, Santa Claus. Life seems easy. When her father passes, Noel's brother, Nick, must become the new Santa Claus. But Nick feels pressured, and what sounded like a weekend getaway turns into a week of his absence. Noel travels to Phoenix, Arizona, to rescue not only her brother, but Christmas too.
And did you enjoy it, George?
I did, actually. There's a lot of naff, rubbishy Christmas films out there. And I was expecting this to be that, especially as a kind of straight to Disney Plus Disney movie. But I actually thought it was pretty well written, was actually quite funny, had comedians as the actors. And if anything, I think it was a mashup, I think, of Elf, the fish out of water North Poler who knows Santa coming to our world and not really knowing how to interact with it and being too over enthusiastic with Christmas joy. A mixture of that and Fred Claus, in which Vince Vaughn played the brother to Paul Giamatti's Santa Claus. Apparently there's also one called Santa Baby, which I've not seen, where I think Renee Zellweger is Santa's daughter as well, but I haven't got around to that one just yet.
Yeah, I definitely made the Elf comparison, and it made me wonder now, where did the whole trope begin of Santa's kind of misfit relatives, or Santa having like a brother or a son or whatever who is not like him at all? Like, I feel like that has been around for a while now, and I'm wondering where it started. But that's another episode. We'll do that next year. Next year's Christmas special. Yeah, similarly, I really enjoyed it. I was not that enthused about it, to be honest. Because it wasn't even totally new. It was on Disney Plus in America last year in 2019, but we didn't have Disney Plus in the UK then, only came out in the spring this year. So it was new to us this year. So I wasn't overly enthused. Like you said, it had a bit of a kind of direct-to-TV movie vibe, kind of a bit of a 90s Disney direct-to-video situation. But it was really sweet. I mean, I'm a sucker for I'm a sucker for a lot of things, but I'm definitely a sucker for like an emotional kind of tug at the heartstrings Christmas movie. All it has to do is mention like, you know, a dead relative and play something that sounds like it could have been written by John Williams, and I'm anybody. So I was crying within about like 5 minutes of this starting. Oh, my wife was watching me from the other side of the room. So no, yeah, really sweet, funny. I laughed out loud. If it was a little bit disjointed, maybe. I could have done with one or two bigger stars in it, but overall, I'd really recommend this, and I would watch it again. Actually, that's what I thought afterwards. I was like, yep, I'd put that on again next year to feel Christmassy. So yeah, I would definitely endorse Noel. Anna Kendrick is really, really charming as the lead. If we think about some of the threads that we could pull out of this, one of the crises that drives the plot along is that when Nick the new Santa goes missing. Their cousin Gabe is appointed in his place to become Santa, and he's the tech support at the North Pole. He's not cut out for the big job, and so he brings to bear on the naughty and nice list his algorithms. The world, of course, now everyone is run by algorithms, by the surveillance capitalists who are watching you and know you better than you know yourself. And so, you know, it was nice. That was nice and contemporary without feeling too forced. I thought that could feel really kind of, like I said, a bit of a naff joke, but it felt okay. Delivered really well by the guy who plays Gabe, Billy Eichner. Is that it? We checked his name earlier. Who I just knew as Craig from Parks and Rec. So if you're a Parks and Rec fan, you will know exactly. And he brings that same energy to this. And his algorithm discovers that there are only 2,837 nice children in the whole world, and they are. They are the only children who are going to get presents. George, as a reformed evangelical Christian, I was conflicted at that point. The naughty and nice list is probably one of the elements of the Santa story that the most gets the goat of evangelical Christians, especially if you're a parent. Part of me was thinking, well, nobody's really nice. Didn't you know that? Even your algorithm doesn't get it all right. You know, there's nobody righteous, not even one. Yet also
Calvinist
another
Santa.
Calvinist Santa. Yeah, he doesn't need to check his list twice. It's already been predestined, so why would he need to check it? That side of me, but then also part of me. Railing against the idea, as the film does, that you know you can just determine everything about a person with an algorithm. What did you make of the fact that he comes up with so few nice children in the world, George? Were you thinking, oh, that's not very fair, or were you thinking, no, none of them are nice at all?
It did make me laugh because that is a good gag first and foremost. But then I also did think, yeah, he's got a point. He's being fiercely logical about it, like. We are, you know, as Christians, we know by default we are bad but capable of good, whereas the kind of, I guess, the secular worldview would say we are by default good and we learn to be bad. So I quite liked it that it was saying not many of them are good. But then I guess the response to that would kind of be, well, if Noelle was told that, I guess the her kind of chipper Santa Claus-y attitude to that would be, well, that may be, but you know, grace. We still want to bless the children with presents. I guess that's the attitude I would take to it.
Yeah, definitely. Also, though, I think it tees up a good chance maybe to think about what Christians mean when they say they believe in, if we're going back to our Calvinism, total depravity, the T of tulip. So that doesn't mean that we believe that everyone is as awful as they could be. It just means that we believe that sin touches everything. It's not doesn't totally overtake everything, but it is total in that it's present in every aspect of life. There's nothing that the sin hasn't touched. That doesn't mean it's taken everything over. So, okay, we believe that nobody is righteous, but we don't believe that nobody is nice. So I think that's maybe where his algorithm fell down for me, and that, you know, we still believe that by common grace there's goodness and niceness in whoever it is. So, you know, if Santa was going on a nice list, I think he probably would find a lot more than 2,837 nice children in the world. But like I said, it was just a good gag, which did make me chuckle and was really well delivered by Billy Eichner. And that as well, the idea of whether you can properly measure someone by an algorithm, again, I thought was quite on point, not especially deep, but I enjoy that he was then put in his place at the end of the film. His technology wasn't totally irredeemable, but when it took center stage and was the way of running everything, that's when it became a problem. But it needed to be put in its proper relation to, you know, kind of human wisdom and management, when you live in a world where we're told that the ads that come at us constantly, the way that we spend our time online is all organized and run by some mysterious algorithm off in the cloud. is a nice little observation. So I enjoy that side of it. The other big thing in it is about tradition. So Noel isn't allowed at first to take over the mantle of being Santa Claus. Big spoiler here, in the end she does end up being Santa Claus, because it's thought that, you know, their understanding of like the Christmas code or whatever it is, the laws of the North Pole, that the next Santa has to be like the male heir. There's quite a comprehensive like background story to Santa in this as well. Like, there isn't one Santa, it's like a title that's been inherited by like primogeniture over like a millennia and a half. But you know, tradition means they don't think that a woman can take on that role, even though she has all the gifts and even though her brother is incredibly ill-suited for it. And in the end they realize that actually the laws don't say that. They don't say it has to be the boy. It's just a tradition that's grown up over the years, but they kind of, there's a bit of a reformation in the North Pole, I think. They go back to the sources. They look at what the text actually says. What did you think about that side of it, George, about her being ultimately able to take over the role, kind of in spite of the fact that she's a woman? And was it preachy? Did it work? Were you punching the air going, yeah, you go, sister? How did that strike you?
Well, I mean, clearly it's supposed to be, it's one of the first Disney Plus films. It's supposed to be, I guess, from a Disney perspective, a progressive Christmas film. And to be fair, I don't think that's ever been done before, where the new Santa Claus isn't someone who inherits it, because often in these films, like the Santa Claus, you know, another guy takes over. But I've never seen a woman become Santa Claus, because, you know, people think, well, Santa Claus is the Coca-Cola guy in his jolly fat guy in a red suit. You can't be Santa Claus. That'll be the initial thought, and I'm sure some people will watch it and think, no, I don't like that. That's not right. She can't be Santa Claus, which is the reaction when she does her first Christmas trip from some of the children. You're not Santa Claus. You don't look like Santa Claus. But there has to be a distinction here that it's a job, whereas it was kind of treated like it was this thing that only one type of person could be, just because everyone else before them had been that. I mean, a comparison would be like, you know, who should be the next James Bond? And the character, the producers behind James Bond have said James Bond will always be a man, because he's James Bond. He's, you know, he's just, we were talking about multiverses earlier. There's multiverses of Ian Fleming's character, and he's a guy called James Bond. He's a very masculine character. Now, of course, you could argue Santa Claus is a masculine character, but in terms of just doing the job of having Christmas cheer and being responsible for delivering the presents in this Noel universe, it is a job that Noel is very suited to, and clearly better than her parents. And so, the comparison I'd make with James Bond is, in the new film No Time to Die, James Bond supposedly has retired, and so his 007 status has been left open. And so he's been replaced by a woman, which says, okay, a woman can't be James Bond, but a woman can be 007, because she can do the same job as James Bond. Now, Noelle isn't her father, that Santa Claus, whatever his real name is. I'm sure they're not all called Santa Claus. Her brother was just called Nick. I'm sure some of them are called St. Nicholas. But as it's a job. That's what I'm saying. It's a job, and she has every right to do it. And clearly she was the one best suited to do that with the gifts she had. And you could see the different gifts in her family. Her brother was really good on the tech side of things, and she was clearly best suited to take over her father's job in that position. Yeah,
definitely. I think the way that the, like I said, the tradition worked. It seemed that the elves who made the decisions were sort of constitutional literalists, in that, you know, they went back and looked at what the text actually said, what the kind of founding documents laid out, and then set about deciding whether unhelpful, or not necessarily unhelpful, but just extraneous traditions had grown up around their idea of who was going to be Santa Claus. And it's just a good prompt when we think about gender roles, which are constantly up for debate and kicked about these days, even among people who, you know, cards on the table, as George and I would be, relatively within church context conservative about such things, to always be examining whether actually what you think is just an unhelpful, well, not even unhelpful, but a tradition that has arisen at some point but isn't necessarily what it was about in the first place. Not to say that you do away with those divisions between men and women entirely, as the world these days is wont to do, but working out what actually is just tradition that actually can be much more flexible than we like it to be. And get the qualities that she needs to be Santa in this are things that aren't gendered. That's a key thing, I think, to note about it. We've talked before about, you know, the idea of the strong female protagonist, who's often just a female protagonist who, by some, you know, quirk of, like, you know, being Trinity in the Matrix, who knows Kung Fu, manages to somehow be as physically intimidating and able as a man is, and that's why she's a strong female character. But that isn't really a good female character, because she doesn't overcome with qualities that are either shared between the sexes and where they're on an equal footing, or that are uniquely female. And in this, she has these certain qualities that either a man or a woman could have, where she can understand different languages and tell who's naughty and who's nice, that her brother just doesn't have. And that's how she is then suited for the job. So it's not by kind of becoming like a man that she then manages to take on this role, but by simply kind of excelling in these relatively genderless qualities. So I took the generous reading of kind of what it was saying with regards to gender roles in this, and enjoyed it. And we'll watch it again next year. Any more thoughts on Noel, George?
I'll just say something that really warmed my heart in it. And similarly, there's something in the next film we're going to talk about too, was when she was wandering around Phoenix, Arizona, and they were kind of teasing that she had I'm going to say seasonal gifting, to be the Santa Claus. She was, wherever she went, she would bring a radical kind of kindness and love to everyone in an unexpected way. Like, people were quite surprised by her and reacted to that. And it just made me think, gosh, I want to be like that as a Christian, being that radically different in social settings in a way that's really, really stands out in the way that you exude, you know, a Christian joy and kindness to the world.
Mm-hmm. Evangelism, according to Noel, yeah? Great. Okay, well, that's Noel. We are going to go on to another Christmas film here. Netflix's The Christmas Chronicles 2. Now, I hadn't watched Christmas Chronicles 1 before we agreed to do that, and I watched the two of them back to back. So, you know, that's an option that's open to you as well if you've not seen Christmas Chronicles 1, which we'll probably talk about a bit as we review it. So stick around as we talk about Christmas Chronicles 2. Usually at this point I would ask George what's it all about, and he would give you the synopsis of the film. However, due to some technical quirk, we've missed that little bit of the audio, so I'm going to give you the synopsis of Christmas Chronicles 2. The sequel to Netflix's original Christmas Chronicles takes place 2 years after the first film. Kate Pierce is now a cynical preteen, unhappy at her family Christmas, where her mum is together with her new partner Bob. Her brother Teddy from the first film is off with his girlfriend, and she is stuck with her new potential stepbrother Jack. They're caught up again in the antics of Kurt Russell's Santa Claus, and in the mix is a nefarious, vengeful elf called Belstickle. Once again, of course, they have to save Christmas. Now, back to normal, hear me and George talk about it.
So, yeah, Christmas Chronicles 1 came out, was it last year, George, or 2 years ago?
2 years ago. I expect there'll be a third one in another two.
And Santa Claus, is it? I mean, this isn't your grandma's Santa Claus, George, is it?
No, this is a very boisterous 21st century sunglasses and electric guitar Santa Claus. Well, no, saxophone Santa Claus in Kurt Russell, who I think is one of the best movie Santa Clauses I've ever seen.
Yes. Yeah. I think as being Santa Claus, it must be one of those roles that, like, you wait, you know, to a certain point in your career until you think, yes, now I'm ready to play this role. Like being Lear or Prospero or something like that. Yes, I can be Santa now. And did you enjoy Christmas Chronicles 2, George?
Yes, I enjoyed it more than the first one. I can't remember the first one that well because I saw it 2 years ago. I didn't really watch it before this one, but I remember thinking it was fine. And it was, to me, the first one felt a bit like a Netflix kind of B movie, but I did prefer this one more. I think partly because Christopher Columbus wrote and directed the second one, whereas he only produced the first one. And Christopher Columbus is best known for really warm, friendly family films like Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire, the first two Harry Potter films. And so he knows how to make a fun family Christmas film. And I really felt that with this. But as you told me before we recorded, Reese, you felt it was a very different film to the first one.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I watched them both back to back and really enjoyed the first one way more than I thought I would. I was not that at all bothered about it, which is, I guess, why I didn't watch it when it came out or last year. But then did this year, and yeah, it's got a lot of heart. Really sweet. Kurt Russell is great. I feel like there's a very good film just buried within it. A bit of a tighter script, a couple of things different. It would be very, very good. But as it said, it was good. I would put it on again next year. And it was this kind of fish out of water Santa film. You know, his sleigh crashes, he gets stuck with these two kids and has to get Christmas back on track. And then it's a bit of a curveball when you finally meet his elves, who are not just small people or, like in Noel, as we were just talking about, just full-grown people. They're these weird little furry creatures who speak some sort of, like, hurky-burky sort of Swedish chef Nordic language. Yeah, George, what are you going to say?
Yeah, I read an interview where Kurt Russell was talking about the language and how they actually made up a language that he spoke phonetically, but he compared it to Passion of the Christ, saying how authentic it was, because Mel Gibson insisted on having proper Aramaic and Hebrew and actually didn't want any subtitles. He said, and he was like, yeah, just like Passion of the Christ, Mel in Passion of the Christ, we're being really authentic in Christmas Chronicles too.
Yeah, I mean, I was sat there like wondering how much depth there was in the language. Like, have they gone full Tolkien and there's a whole system of grammar here? I could write you a dictionary of it. Yeah, who knows? If any idea, if you're a speaker of a Nordic language, then you know, answers on a postcard, please, as to how much resemblance this actually bears to your language. Yeah, so first one, really sweet, bit of a kind of fantasy curveball. And then this was just a sort of a full-blown kind of kids fantasy, bit of a video game kind of fetch quest vibe in the story. Didn't dislike it, just very, very different to the first. You know, the first one, again, had me in tears, I'll be honest, like, numerous times. Again, my wife watched
it. Oh, no, I love this one.
yeah, but enjoyable, a fun family film. It still has some heart, still has some sweetness. It's worth it for Kurt Russell, to be honest. He is full of charisma. He's a great Santa. A big musical number in each film as well. Again, kind of out of nowhere, so slightly like tonally uneven. But it's worth it. Oh yeah, for Kurt Russell cutting loose in a couple of kind of rock and roll soul musical numbers. Yeah, when we're batting around kind of what we can draw out of this, George, you were struck by a prodigal son narrative to the film, weren't you?
Yes, and just to disclose, full spoilers from here out, but you know, it's a kid's Christmas film, so maybe you don't mind. But yeah, oh, just before I say that, it's also worth pointing out, we've got to say Goldie Hawn is playing Mrs. Claus. Goldie Hawn is like Kurt Russell's life partner. I mean, they're basically married. They've been together for like 30, 40 years. And I thought it was really lovely that they're playing Mr. and Mrs. Claus together.
Aww.
Played that very well. Yes, so Prodigal Son. Yes, so the baddie is this, I can't remember his name, he's the New Zealand actor from
Belsnickel. Oh no, the actor
from
Sorry.
All the People. Yes, but yes, he plays
Julian Dennison. Julian Dennison.
That's it. Yeah, there we go. And his backstory is he's the naughty elf at the North Pole, and he just keeps breaking the rules. Although in the Mrs. Claus keeps saying he keeps breaking transgressions again and again and again, breaking all the transgressions, and they don't understand why he's doing it. And he says he hates humans, and then he ends up turning into what he hates, a human, and runs away and tries to form his own place at the South Pole. And to do this, he decides to steal the star from the top of the Christmas tree. The star is the Star of Bethlehem. We'll get to that in a minute.
And it powers the North Pole. Yeah, sorry.
Yes, it powers the North Pole. He wants to take it away and take it for himself. Basically, he wants to wreck everything. He's the baddie. But towards the end of the film, he is defeated. But there is redemption for this villain, because rather than binding him, punishing the bad elf, giving him his just desserts, Santa Claus, who is this kind of father figure, welcomes him home with open arms. He blesses him by giving him a Christmas present, which in complete grace after everything he's done. And it's the first Christmas present they made together. And he's so touched by this that he turns back into an elf, which is what he was originally designed for, what he was originally meant to be. And he realizes that his family is the most important thing. And really he was rebelling against what he was looking for. And so that's why I thought, we try not to Jesus Duke here, but I just thought this would be a cracking sermon illustration right there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Returning to what he was designed to do in the first place, back to his the task he was given, the mandate he was given. I like that. I'll give you that. As you've described it, that's reminded me of what we said about Christmas films last year, especially when we were talking about Last Christmas with Emilia Clarke, and when we got onto Christmas Carol as well, that Christmas films are often about how people change, how you go from, how Scrooge goes from being, Scrooge to being this generous, giving, man who's loved by all. And I guess that's a similar thing here, that you have this twisted, bitter, hurt character in Belsnickel, which is a name I can't say without having a little chuckle. And eventually, yeah, he's changed by love, by grace, by being welcomed home at Christmas time. So it kind of fits quite nicely into that, that strong pedigree of Christmas films about how people change. A weird thing, though, is how it ends. And one of the kind of thematic emotional threads through the film is that the dad of I was about to say the two lead children in the first film, the two lead children, brother and sister, but in this one, the dad of Kate I've forgotten the older brother's name, Teddy. He's died before the start of the first film. His favorite Christmas song apparently is "Oh Christmas Tree." Now it falls down for me there. That's no one's favorite Christmas song. It's like a nursery rhyme. Like you sing it as a joke when you're decorating the Christmas tree, and not really any other time. But the film ends with them all stood around the people on Earth on the beach, singing "Oh Christmas Tree" together, like swaying and looking out at the sea. And then up in the North Pole, them all kind of gathered round their big North Pole Christmas tree. But it has this kind of, we were saying, sense of religious transcendence of singing "Oh Christmas Tree." Kind of given also by the kind of Christian trappings that come through the film. We haven't talked about Santa origins either. This has, I think, the best you could hope for in terms of accurate, actual St. Nicholas whilst also having Father Christmas. So he, George, give us the origin story for Santa according to Christmas Chronicles 2.
Yeah, I loved this on one level because they never do this in Santa movies. I was thinking before they did this bit, I was thinking someone needs to make a Christmas movie that is purely about the real St. Nicholas, like a proper Santa origins movie. That would be epic. And they actually go back here, because usually it's kind of like, I think in the Dudley Moore one, it's kind of like a bloke who comes across some elves, or there's something just kind of folklore-y and Norse, or, you know, tied into Odin or whatever. But this went right explicitly back to the Christian origins, and Mrs. Claus is like, it was the year was 312. Santa was called St. Nicholas. He was a bishop in Asia Minor.
Which is good, because that's 3 years before the Council of Nicaea. Nicholas, as we know, is contending for Orthodox Christology and, you know, building Christian Orthodoxy. Hey ho. Ho 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 ho, should I say. That's good. Carry on, George.
And there's Kurt Russell in his dyed brown beard, because he's supposed to be
looking a little bit Middle Eastern.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I was thinking he's supposed to be Turkish. Okay, interesting. He puts I think, is it coins in the shoes? Is that the history of St. Nicholas, Reese? Yeah. Allegedly. So it's like, oh great, so he was a bishop. But at some point he decided to stop being a bishop and he met these elves in the woods, and he's given like the power of what's called the Star of Bethlehem, which it later becomes apparent is the literal Star of Bethlehem that led the Magi to Bethlehem, to the nativity scene. And he basically goes to the North Pole, and it's this power, this Star of Bethlehem, which is on top of the Christmas tree, which kind of powers Santa Town, Christmas Town, and the Christmas spirit and joy and everything, which is then taken by the baddie, but then is restored because Santa gets a new one from Turkey. But at the end, they're all around the Christmas tree, kind of worshipping transcendently this Star of Bethlehem, which is linked, we know is linked to Jesus, but it's never mentioned, and back to when he was St. Nicholas and was a bishop. And they're all kind of reaching out to this, to the kind of the joy of Christmas, or the joy of secular Christmas, but that's it. And it's really kind of frustrating as a Christian to see that right at the end, but I mean, it's not, I don't think it's surprising either.
No, I think the presence of the Star of Bethlehem in there, and the kind of trappings of the Christian story of Christmas, give it this kind of transcendent afterglow. In the first film as well, there's a scene where they're sit outside a church, the two siblings, and the older brother Teddy's like, oh, I haven't been to church since dad died, and the younger one's like, yeah, me neither. And like, they're not jaded 30 somethings who, you know, whose old parent has just died. Their kids live in the same house, like they don't need to have this, you know, guilty conversation where neither of them realizes the other one hasn't been to church. But again, that adds this kind of transcendent choral music thing in the background, which is never then acted upon. But the transcendent sense that gives is then transplanted into something else. So it kind of, you know, brushes up against Christianity, but then takes what it gets from that and shoves it into the Christmas tree, shoves it into the kind of de-Christianized secular symbol. I'm not railing against Christmas trees, by the way, as like a pagan thing. That's daft. I love Christmas trees. That just, it's just weird for one thing, very weird, and shows this desperate need at Christmas time for something magical, something transcendent. That C.S. Lewis, there we go, sound the klaxon, C.S. Lewis, capital J joy. But it can only get it by rubbing up against Christianity. And then they sing O Christmas Tree. And they say, oh, let's have a caroling session. Oh, what carol should we sing? Oh, let's sing O Christmas Tree. Like, no one wants to sing O Christmas Tree if you're having a caroling session. It's rubbish. You want to sing, and then we can't, you know, you feel this even more at the minute since we can't sing Christmas carols this year. You want to belt out Hark the Herald or O Come All Ye Faithful, getting louder and louder each time you sing Come Let Us Adore Him. Like, it's just so paper thin. Yeah, and can only get any depth and any transcendence by smuggling it in from Christianity, but then papering it over and putting a different skin on it and trying to pretend that that it isn't that. Yeah, so a bit weird. And also, we said a bit Indiana Jonesy in that this is a world where there is magic and there are elves, yet the Star of Bethlehem is an actual thing with some sort of crazy, like, you know, melt the face off the Nazis sort of power. As, you know, Indiana Jones, you know, the Ark of the Covenant is still the presence of God, and the Crusades are a thing, and there's an immortal man drinking from the Holy Grail, and the Hindu gods are also there in some way in the inappropriate Temple of Doom, whatever it might be. It's a very dense, like, bit of world building, surprisingly, in these films, George, right?
Yeah, it's weird how they... Well, on one level, I was like, I'm amazed that they are even referencing this bishop in in 4th century Turkey. I liked that. It's like, oh, that's cool. They haven't done that before, and it's going back to the origins. And the Star of David, Star of Bethlehem. But it just, if you stop and you think about it, it doesn't satisfy, doesn't make sense. It's trying to make both exist at the same time without really referring to the Christ in the Christmas Chronicles, which is it's there, and you're like, if you stop and think, you're like, okay, so is this Turkish Santa Claus, is he still a bishop, but he's now magic, so he's like a wizard dude who tells everyone to be good. So he's a false teacher. No, as you don't want to overthink it, do you?
Yeah. Because he's gone from defending Christology to promoting Pelagianism. Yeah,
exactly. But I just think it's, you know, if you're Christopher Columbus is writing this, you know, they're producing an American secularist Christmas film for Netflix that gives you all the feels and sentimentality. And they want to give that transcendence at the end, where it's this weird scene of the family on the beach and then all the elves and Santa all round the tree, like worshipping it kind of like an idol. But we do also know that there's that Star of David, that light that is linked to the baby in the feeding trough in the stable. But they can't get over that line.
Yeah.
To say that's where the source of all the Christmas joy, everything that we want from Christmas is right there, but they won't go there.
Yeah, and there's this desperation for something to praise, and a secular Christmas ultimately becomes something that eats itself, because it's only about itself in the end. Christmas is about Christmas. That is where you get to when you take Christ out of it. It's just... It's a holiday for its own sake. Mm. It's not, you know, it's not even a pagan thing where, oh, in the depths of winter we'll have a period of feasting to cheer ourselves up so that we don't all die or commit suicide or kill each other before the spring comes. We're all fine and healthy and live indoors. So it's every Christmas song is only about Christmas, or is increasingly probably about trying to recapture the magic of what we feel like Christmas was like in the 90s and the 80s when we were all kids. And that is this, like, they're all, you know, they can't stand in church worshipping Christ. They stand looking out at the sea, which, you know, is like the closest thing to a holy object they can find, or around a Christmas tree, singing at that, but kind of looking sideways at each other, like no object to focus their joy and worship on. Yeah, cool. I've got a lot more heated about this whilst talking about it than I did while watching it. But it wasn't bad, you know, we both enjoyed it. Yeah. I feel, but, I mean, maybe this proves my point, the first one's better.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the thing with these films, like, on one level I really enjoyed The Christmas Chronicles too. It was a good fun adventure. It was funny. There was time travel.
We didn't even mention that
to those Christmas origins. Yeah I know. But then on the other level, you know, as Christians, we don't just want to watch these films and consume them in a kind of gluttony of the pleasure of Christmas there with our mince pies and must watch the Santa Claus film to make myself feel good. Like, it's so important. I guess that's the purpose of our podcast, is it to really be to be thinking about what we're watching and taking away, as Reese, you like to say, plundering the Egyptians, like the prodigal son stuff we talked about. That I thought that was the grace that Santa Claus showed the villain. That was great. But Boo sucks to the Christmas tree at the end. But at least we can say, I mean, yeah, they're looking for it, but at least at the top there's that Star of Bethlehem, which is not what they're looking for, but is leading them to what really they're looking for, the source of that Christmas joy.
Amen and amen. We'll wrap up our review of Christmas Chronicles 2 there, but go give it a watch. Give Christmas Chronicles 1 a watch, definitely. Anyway, I'll as the guy who tends to wrap up, I can slip that final word in there. So this episode should go up roughly mid-December. And we are hoping to have another one for you between Christmas and New Year, with a couple of things that are coming out just before Christmas, but we will we'll keep our powder dry and won't promise that to you yet. Things are a bit well, I did mention this. We've had a new baby arrive. Not me and George, sorry, this isn't one of those. Me and Mrs. Mannering, who is off screen in these episodes, had a little boy arrive last week. One of the reasons why we were a bit delayed in getting any more episodes out to you. So hopefully I will get to the cinema to see one of the things that we want to talk about. But watch this space. However, if you want to get in touch with us with any thoughts on our festive ramblings, then you can do that on Twitter at For Now We See Pod, or you can email us at For Now We See Podcast at gmail.com. George, before we properly wrap up, any closing Christmas wishes you want to impart to our listeners?
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We I'm not going to sing Oh Christmas Tree to you. But thanks for listening. It's been over a year now. So thanks for sticking with us. Mm-hmm. Or welcome if you're a new listener. And whilst the pandemic's going on, hope and pray that you have a warm family time focused on what really matters, on what that Star of Bethlehem was pointing to, on Christ incarnate. So yeah, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a blessed New Year.
Mm-hmm. And until next time, whenever that might be, my name is Reese, and I'm a Bible college student.
And I'm Bell Snickle. I mean, I'm George, and I'm a film journalist.
Merry Christmas, and we hope that's all right.
Well, now that's all right, now, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, now, Mama. Any way you do, but that's all right.